tomorrow all the things were gone. I'd worked for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife. I thank my lucky stars to be living here today,
where the flag still stands for freedom, and they can't take that away.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today, 'cause there ain't no doubt our love has left this land.
God bless the USA.
God bless the USA.
Fabulous, Thumper, fabulous. Thank you for that great lead-in again. I have to thank Lee Greenwood. And the this is the Air Force singing sergeants that perform with him. That's a fantastic video. I've got a great person on today, a great guest on, a friend who he's become a friend over the last, I don't know, probably 8 years, something like that. Jeff, I met for the first time when he was doing his book tour in Montana. He has a book that is very, very patriotic, America's Last Stand. I'm going to let Jeff tell a little bit more about his book during the interview, but I also wanted to mention that Jeff is former Navy crypto. He also became quite a technology expert in security in New York and Washington, D.C., and then the whole East Coast. He kind of did himself a favor and retired fairly early on when he realized the direction that the country was heading. And he moved to Idaho. He's living in Idaho with his wife. He's got a wonderful family. And Jeff, I want to welcome you to the program. Do you want to add anything to your bio that you think would be important for the listeners to know?
First of all, good afternoon, Dan. It's very good to be on your program again, and good to see you.
Yeah.
I think the only thing to really add for most people's use would be prepared for a little bit to receive quite a bit of information here on our topic today, because I'm going to try and cover quite a range of ground. And there's a couple of things that people want to make, if people want to make notes to remember, I recommend that they do that, because in a program like this and with the topic involved, there's a lot of information to absorb, especially right now with what's going on. So I guess just to have something to take a couple of notes with, so people can research further on their own later, would be good.
Well, Jeff, one of the things we are going to do, and I don't normally take questions as part of my program, but we're going to, in the second hour of the program, we're going to be entertaining questions from our viewers and our listeners. So we've got a chat line that sometimes just absolutely blows you away how many people are on that chat line. And we are going to be taking legitimate questions on the subject matter. And that's going to be, we're going to be talking about sound money. We're going to be talking about what's been happening in the United States today, and how that whole program is just out of control almost, and how the cryptocurrency, how the idea of blockchain technology might provide an opportunity for people to see something and do something with their finances that they can't normally do if they don't have any information on it. And Jeff has got so much valuable information. We've done a number of these programs in the past, but it's been a while. And I've had a lot of our viewers and our listeners have been sending me notes and asking me if this is a subject area that we would be willing to cover. And I definitely think that this is a good opportunity to do that. Jeff, I'm looking forward to this. I think there's going to be so much information that you can provide. And let's start off with the basic question. What is blockchain technology? What is the basis for the whole idea of cryptocurrencies, and how did it develop? How did it start? And then how can we take advantage of this information in an investing environment? So Jeff, with that, let's hear what you've got to say.
Thank you, Dan. And I think first of all, one of the things that's important is to give people a little bit of background before we drop directly into blockchain itself and the concepts involved. To understand why this is occurring right now and what is going on in the blockchain and cryptocurrency phenomena, I think people have to kind of take a step back and review how we got here. And why this phenomena happens to be taking off right now. And I think the biggest part of that is that a lot of people starting back in the early 2000s began to realize that there were definitely problems. And after the 2008 financial crisis, it became very clear that we were headed to some big problems. And the response of the institutions involved, the central banks, the Federal Reserve, the big banks, and the whole banking system, in fact, was to go right back into this mode of responding with bailouts and TARP and QE and all of these programs that have proceeded in the next 10 years. And what they did it through that, between 2010 and now, essentially, was to blow the debt problem up about four times what it was prior to 2010. If you look at the numbers going back that we were running in the early 2000s, you saw about one quarter of the total debt picture that you see levered on the economy at this point. And just reviewing the figures for this program, I went out and did a and did just a cursory review to scan over the major numbers. At this point, between all of the total debt picture is so horrendous that it defies comprehension. Where the existing world financial structure of the United States is obligated to the tune of about $850 trillion mm-hmm. between corporate debt, government debt, state and local, student loans, house mortgages, virtually all the categories of debt. And then you add the obligations from the unfunded liabilities of the federal government to the credit derivatives that have been created since 2008, and you add all this up, and you're talking about total obligations in the neighborhood of about $850 trillion. Well, that's levered against an economy that produces only 20 to 21 trillion in total GDP or cash flow in the existing economy, the central economy that it's based on. That's 45 times the leverage that's against that cash flow. Any family, any individual, anybody that looked at such a picture in their own finances would realize that they're in deep, deep trouble. And this is something that has occurred so quickly that it's hard to understand. One of the things I always recommend people go do is if your viewers and listeners haven't seen it before, is to go review about a 45 minute video on our existing financial system called Money as Debt. Mm-hmm. And it's a very good short introductory done with very, very plain and simple graphics that illustrates all of the fundamental problems that we have introduced in the last 100 years. Essentially, and this relates directly to what's going on with the concept of cyber currencies and Bitcoin that's currently entering popular understanding. The rise of those currencies was simply an opportunity that hit its mark when people started to realize after 2010, because, I mean, Bitcoin cyber currencies, they didn't even exist at all in any other than conceptually in any idea up until the publishing of the initial white paper by Nakamoto back early 2009. That started to gain, if you will, currency across the internet. And since then, and I read that paper in 2009 and said, you know what, this is an answer, and it's going to have an impact. The only thing but I thought it was like any other of these tech innovations that we've been through in the last 40 to 50 years, is they usually come in phases. And the initial phase, the .0.1 phase, usually doesn't take hold. It's not till version 2 or 3 that all of a sudden the release of this type of technology, of any type of technology, suddenly takes hold. So, unfortunately for myself, and I think it's a good thing. I actually think it's a good thing now, that I didn't jump on my initial idea of investing into any extent in Bitcoin. I wanted to see how it shook out, and I was expecting it would take its normal course of 2 to 3 versions of development before it would finally get a true introduction. But this idea was so current, if you will, in people's minds, it took hold almost immediately. And by the next time I really looked at it in 2014 and 2015, of course, it was really beginning to move. And that's when all the naysaying came out. But if you look at, there are very specific reasons, not only why it started to take hold very early, but why it is going to the idea, the concept of both cyber currency and Bitcoin itself is going to take hold in the economy, are for extremely good reasons. And if you go and watch this Money as Debt presentation, the 45 minute presentation, and just look it up on, just go to Google, go to the search bar and put in Money as Debt, and it'll come right up, and you can watch the whole 45 minutes. And I think people will then begin to understand what has happened. And basically it boils down to one thing. We're coming up to the death of compound interest. The whole concept of the money system that we have today is based on this idea of not only creation of money from nothing, but in the use of compound interest in order to tax, if you will, the use of this system of fiat currency. What we've now reached is in the end of that cycle is we are now in that exponential growth curve at the end of the, and it's inevitable. It was inevitable when they started the system. The people that created the system knew it. There have been, as the Money as Debt video will show, there's endless quotes from people both in and out of the central banking system. They know this. They know this point was coming, where we're going to hit the transition between this system that's failing and the system and having to get back to a transaction and monetary system that works for people in a way that we can both sustain and grow an economy as needed, not as driven. And that's the thing about what compound interest does is it forces the system to grow, whether the system is actually growing itself productively or not. And that's what has created this huge problem of debt in the system, because a fiat money system and a compound interest system, by its very nature, has to continue an exponential growth path. It has no choice. It is the only way it functions, because in the current system, as the video explains, there is no debt. If there is no debt, there is no money. The only way there is money is if it is debt. And that system, anybody can realize, is death to begin with. Mm-hmm. But we've gotten this 100 years. We've gone the full cycle now, and reach the end game, as they call it. We're at the end of the road. And so that's what creates this transition between Bitcoin, between cyber currencies, and the old monetary financial regime that we're coming up to, and is creating a lot of concern, obviously, and a lot of confusion mm-hmm. among people.
Well, Jeff, let me ask you a question that, a lot of people have asked me, and that is this new digital currency that they're talking about, a new world digital currency. Basically, if they can implement that scheme, and it is a scheme, if they can implement that scheme, they can do two things. They can, first of all, print unlimited money and not worry about any interest on that being exposed, because the fact is it's all digital. They can do whatever they want with it, and they can lie about it in any way that they want to, because there's no physical product there that backs it up. And the other part of that is that if they manage to do this digital currency scheme and get away with it, they can also do like they've done in communist China, which is a social credit system where people who step out of line, like you and me, that speak openly about how corrupt the whole system is, can be literally have our credits turned off to the point where we could end up being pawns of a very, very nasty big game where they can control everything that we eat, everything we our jobs, everything that we do, they can control if they finally pull off this one world digital currency idea. I'd love to have you talk about that, because that leads into a further discussion about the cryptos.
Correct. And, you know, it's extremely interesting, because and the confusion of all these different topics between what is digital money versus cyber currency and versus specific implementations like Bitcoin or any of the altcoins is where this is. It becomes really hard to understand. And part of that is going back. Before understanding these initial attempts with cyber currencies to outrun, if you will, the creation of the government or international banking solution of digital money, to understand what really, I mean, when you look at the existing system, the concept of digital money, when you actually break it down and understand the component parts of that technology, it really is fundamentally no different whatsoever than the existing system that we have of fiat currency, because you have to realize that of all the fiat currency that's afloat in the world, of that in those $850 trillion of obligations that exist out there in the form of debt, we don't have $850 trillion of physical notes in circulation anywhere. We don't even have a tiny fraction of that. We have less of all those debts and debt obligations. We don't even have 1% of that in actual cash anywhere in the system. If you just go back and look at the debt money that was created directly out of the Federal Reserve that forms the foundation of all this, we have in that system alone, less than 3% of the money that has been directly generated by the Federal Reserve is represented in Treasury released notes through the Federal Reserve of actual Federal Reserve paper notes. 97% is already electronic, and if you look at all of the obligations and the credit derivatives, all the other money denominated dollars that are represented in these other instruments, financial instruments, none of that is represented in physical currency in circulation. It is all nothing but obligation.
If I could comment here, the problem that I see is that they have issued so much digital currency. Even at the standard commodity rates of everything from sand to diamonds and gold and whatever, they have issued more money than we could buy about 3 or 4 planet Earths just on commodity prices alone for the amount of digital currency that's out there. It's unrealistic. And the only way a system like that actually is able to survive is you have to keep the money moving. You have to keep the faith in the value of that, which is, to me, it's a puff of smoke, because it's only as real as you want to make it. Whereas if we yeah, and it's subject to inflation, deflation, rate setting, all of the abuses that we have seen with the current system, it's subject to that because it's not grounded in anything that I can hold in
tangible.
My hand.
Yeah, tangible.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's not, but if you understand the concepts that underlie the existing financial and banking structure, monetary system, and then if you understand the principles that precede it with the gold standard and how that operated, and then compare that to a concept like cyber currency and cash, you start to realize that a monetary system at its base is all an illusion.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes, I would agree.
All monetary systems that we have today, because people found that gold and metals that were particularly handy and which we came to call precious are very useful. Okay. That is just one of literally hundreds of examples of what can constitute money as long as you constitute it with the right and the three basic properties of money, which is a store of wealth, a unit of account, and a medium of exchange. Those are the three fundamental properties of what actually constitute money. And anything that you can standardize and adhere to those and use for those establishing those three principles can then be used in the issuance of money. The only thing that that was added in the modern central banking and financial system with this was this idea of compound interest that went along with the unanchored property that started with the Federal Reserve note. I mean, even in the fractional reserve, as a fractional reserve said, the fractional reserve gold standard eventually would have led to exactly the same thing, except it would have taken a lot longer than an unlinked fractional reserve system. An unlinked fractional reserve system basically just moved from being 85 to 90% illusion to literally 100% illusion, when the reserve is debt money, just like the principal currency. It's all debt, nothing but debt.
Okay, well, that now we understand that, and I guess I've always been a sound money guy, and I know you were at least in conversations in the past a sound money guy, because there's got to be some value, some basis. If we're going to call something money, there's got to be some basis to it that has some value. That's how you got into the idea of the crypto thing, because of the mining and the actual basis for the whole thing. Talk a little bit about that, about the sound money idea of gold and silver, and then how that translates into some of the research you've done on cryptocurrencies and on the mining process.
Well, exactly, and if you look at the fundamentals of how crypto is quote unquote mined, a lot of people simply don't understand that you can look at the mining of crypto in almost exactly the same way that you can look at the mining of metals in order to establish the initial value. And I've had a lot of people that have come back on me and said, but there's no value in that. And I go, well, there's a lot of value in that. And if you look at the rise in the last 30 years of the information technology industry itself, if there was no value in the ability to of information sciences to process and categorize, contain, distribute, control information, then you have about a third of the world's total GDP today that is completely worthless. But it's not actually, because if you didn't have that, you wouldn't have about 5 of the 7 billion people currently on the planet, because logistically, without the automation, the computer information sciences, and the operation of that system, about 5 billion people would not be able to be sustained in any way on the planet. And so, and this is where the concept of Bitcoin, cyber currency mining, comes into play. It does establish the basic value, just like you now have a great big. It is the same. It's using technology in the same way you use to mine metals out of the ground, to mine the coins that create the transaction currency for the transaction system that they're supplied on. Now understand, we are not anywhere near the monetization of cyber currencies at this point. They're strictly a speculative asset at this point. There is no concerted effort across the altcoins. We haven't reached that stage of development in order to produce actual monetization. So. And we're a ways from that, there's going to be some bumps in the road, but the initiation of the industry and the idea and this concept of producing a transaction system for exchanging value, which is all you need a transaction currency for, is to exchange value that two people, and whether you use seashells like a thousand years ago or a couple thousand years ago, right, or you use this token called Bitcoin, it's really irrelevant to the process as long as you have a way of guaranteeing the verified exchange of value between two players in a transaction. And that's where that is something that especially when it comes to being a store of wealth, where fiat currency is absolutely, when you have an exponentially increasing supply, which is also something that they were very careful to not do within the confines of the algorithm and the software that developed for cyber currencies, to only restrict the supply of the transaction value. And that's something that when you jumped off of the gold standard into a fiat system, you lost the ability to control the value and store the wealth when you, before and after you verify each transaction, when a transaction is made.
Okay, well, I see that, and I see what I would call the price of Bitcoin from going from literally small change to $40,000 is being basically a sign of the inflation built into our whole monetary system. Am I off base in making that assumption?
Well, we actually haven't reached the inflation quote unquote stage yet. What we're in right now is strictly the capital reallocation phase. We have over the last couple of decades, in particular, we have the existing financial system, because of all these credit derivatives and all these other mechanisms, we have indeed, and of course in 2020 we put that process on steroids with all the stimmy package, the stimulus. We put the process of steroids by increasing the monetary base in order to create excess Federal Reserve notes and set up. We preloaded going forward the inflation beast, and it's coming. Mm-hmm. But right now we're not actually in. What we're in right now is what I've always referred to as sector price appreciation that takes place in individual sectors, and that happens when supply and demand dynamics within any particular sector changes. And what's happening with Bitcoin, and the reason that Bitcoin is now currently right up around 60,000 per Bitcoin, is that it is in a sector now that has a lot of the excess money that was previously created that is flowing to it, looking for new assets to invest in. Mm-hmm. And whether it was GameStop, I mean, GameStop was another short stop for this excess money that's already out there. It flows into each one of the particular investment investment sectors as they arise. But actual inflation, you have to remember, in a monetary system, actual inflation is a general increase in the supply of money. It's not the reallocation between different sectors of where money was going versus where it's now going, of existing. It is a general increase in the supply of money across all sectors, and that's when we start experiencing things like what Venezuela and other in Zimbabwe's and the other countries have seen in the past is this general inflationary cycle, which tends to move into the massive. And if really, and if what we think could happen does happen, it could go hyperinflation, but I don't think it's headed there yet.
If I could ask another question here, and by the way, Jeff, welcome to Patriot Soapbox. I'm Thumper.
Thank you.
I understand we're practically neighbors. I'm over in Spokane. So
oh, really? Just a few hundred miles.
One of the things is that, you know, when you were talking about commodity-based financial instruments, i.e. gold, silver, whatever, you have a somewhat finite amount of commodity that can be attributed to your financial supply. Okay, your money supply, right, whatever you call it. Now, I understand that Bitcoin is there are caps on Bitcoin, but that is a man-made arbitrary cap. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's set in the initial algorithm for the creation of the currency, and you have to think of it kind of like you think in mining terms. When they estimate the size of a say a gold deposit when they're getting ready to mine it, and how big and how far it's going to go until it runs out, but it has right. Yeah, it has a finite length to it.
Okay. Well, and again, you know, I think that, you know, they kind of promised the same thing when we got the Federal Reserve and the central banks, you know, that there would be a limit on the amount of fiat currency that was issued. And now there's basically no limit. They put the darn thing on steroids and juiced it up with a little nitrous oxide and maybe a little nitromethane as well. And, you know, they put the pedal to the metal and they're driving us over the edge of the, you know, a million miles an hour. And, you know, whenever you put something like that in the hands of man, they typically, you know, usually screw it up. And they could arbitrarily decide that we're going to change the algorithm at some point in the future to allow more of this Bitcoin to be created, where we go back to what you were just talking about. And that's this more money out there. You have the Weimar Republic, the Venezuela, you know, all over again.
Well, there's and you're correct. There is a problem that exists. One of the things that was most made most difficult in the very design and architecture of cyber currency, Bitcoin's. Remember, Bitcoin was simply the first example, and that these other altcoins and things that are coming along now are based mostly on the same architecture, but they're working in the technology to work out any problems like this that might have existed. And what you're talking about has always been known in the Bitcoin world as the double spend or the forking problem, where the blockchain could fork, be made to fork and start generating a whole nother processing
kind
line,
like splitting stocks.
Yeah, in similarity. But this is but understand that even in the initial system design that was developed for blockchain, and this kind of goes into a little bit of what is a blockchain and how does it work. That is an incredibly difficult technical problem to overcome in an established blockchain, and is the best thing is it's immediately identifiable in the way that the blockchain works. Mm-hmm. So this double spend problem, and like I said, there've been quite a few attempts, and many things have happened, and to this point, the architecture itself has held up pretty well, and I think when the second tier currencies begin to take hold, you'll see that the problem is solved. The two sets of problems that are created, one, which is the amount of computer power alone that it simply takes to process the last 10% of the mined coins. That's the biggest part of the problem. Is the first 90, as you, when you start mining coins, it starts out very easy, but the more and more coins you mine, the ability of the processing power to mine the coins and verify the transactions consumes more and more and more power and processing cycles in order to do. And when you get to the last 10%, especially the last 5%, just like when you start having a mine, a physical mine that starts running to the end of the ore find, it becomes less and less profitable to do, because the power increases, the processing cycles increase, the investment involved. When you come right up to the last point, the processing power required to mine the last few coins becomes incredibly expensive in order to do that. And that's when you start having these giant server farms out there that with the cost of the power and the hardware and the software and everything involved, it starts narrowing the players who could even attempt it. And it makes it, the problem of the double spend and the forking is every bit as difficult, and against the existing system, it's much easier to detect much sooner if it is attempted, and if somebody does it. And the problem is for the people that may attempt something like this, just like counterfeiters getting into the scheme, they have to invest an enormous amount of money, time, software, engineering development, and all this. And if it's detected, they lose instantly.
So
because right.
Who are the miners? Who is somebody let's say I wanted to be a Bitcoin miner. Okay. And I wanted to, what kind of an investment does that entail? I can go out and buy a cheap pan and go out to find a stream where I can pan for gold or whatever. I'm not going to probably make a fortune at it, but
that's the same thing for a Bitcoin miner. My son out in has a two processor setup out in the garage, and he mines a couple of altcoins and Bitcoin every day, all day long. That's just like having a gold pan and a shovel in a shaker table and running out on a stream somewhere. He's a miner. Or you could, on the other end of the scale, you can have a 50,000 square foot warehouse full of servers mining coins all day long, and on a huge scale, and have that investment. You just like you have giant gold mine metals companies that exist in the metals market. So you have that entire range available. No, he doesn't make big money, but he makes money. He nets money every month in his mining operation.
Kind of Jeff, I need to have you explain how the blockchain process works, because there's a lot of people that don't understand exactly what blockchain is. And if we're going to have further discussion about this, they need to understand how that blockchain process works.
Well, exactly. And this is the key. The key to understanding is understanding the two basic components of the cyber currency system. And the underlying component is the blockchain itself, and the next layer up is the token layer. That's mm-hmm. or I think it's as good to refer to it as the application layer. The blockchain level actually has been around since the late 70s, early 80s in various forms. It started out as what we used to call LRC or CRC, cyclic redundancy checking or linear redundancy checking. Basically, the idea was is that to create a secure, verifiable block of data that you transmit across a network, say it's 1,000 bits. Well, in a error correction and bit checking scheme, you do that by blocks of data. When you want to transmit a block of data across the network, you want to make sure that the 1,000 bits of data that you sent from site A to site B arrives with 100% data integrity, so that you know that the bits sent are the bits received before you even attempt to decode and find out what's in it. So there were various schemes to develop, known as LRC, CRC, and then they just proliferated from there. In cyclic redundancy checking, they were simply mathematical algorithms that when you had a block of data on the send side to transmit the 1,000 bits, you would run a mathematical formula through that bit plane, through the bit pattern, and you would produce a mathematical result. The mathematical result would then be appended to the data in the data block and transmitted with the data. Okay. Mm. So when it gets to the other end, the LRC or CR or cyclic redundancy check would be rerun against the bit pattern of the data content of the block, and then they right at the end they'd see if the result that they got matched the result that was sent. If it does, that means you have a good data block. Okay, well, when you can multiply this kind of a scheme, and that's what creates the blockchain. Now, in a 3D, three-dimensional fashion, if you will, you have planes of data that are concatenated together, and as you concatenate that data together, you run a very complex set of formulas against through that data block, and the basic data block is 1 megabit, 1 million bits of data, and it contains all the information from transactions that were completed, coins that were added, in intervals that are constantly running on the entire global network. You have thousands and thousands of computers that are set up to check these blocks of data independently of each other. As the data blocks of a million bits, of each million bit block is checked, everybody does their calculations independently, and then they compare at regular intervals to see if what was in this block that this guy saw matches with what that guy saw, and that guy, and that guy, and that guy. And then they go through a voting process. And when everybody is in agreement that all of their calculations say that all of their independent verification of the data is correct, that then generates a block check, if you will, for the entire block of a million bits, and that gets added to the like I said, I don't want to get too technical here, but it creates a summation mm-hmm. check mm-hmm. for the entire block that you can then go back and verify at any time. And you can also use to access the block and to check the block at any time in the future to see if the all the data contained in there is still correct. And boom, you begin the process all over again with the next block. And that mm-hmm. is the chain of blocks, the blockchain that you're creating as transactions, coins, and everything is proceeding with any particular. And it's independent of any human third-party verification whatsoever. It is mathematics. That mm-hmm. is all. It's mathematics. And any attempt that is made to try and interfere with those mathematics becomes extremely difficult when it can be independently verified, checked, and rechecked by so many entities to get in the middle of that and try and diddle with it that nobody's going to see. It becomes very mm-hmm. hard.
Got it. Well, that makes sense. And that also kind of defines the mining process, because the mining process is just a continuation of that verification process. Isn't that right?
That's correct. And yeah. And you can see that the bigger and bigger that the blockchain goes in you know, you're adding coins to it all the way down as you mine, and those are going into the blockchain as you're adding to the reserve, mm-hmm. The mined reserve that comes out and gets added to the blockchain. You can see the further you go down the blockchain, when you come to the end, when you're mining coins, you got to go back and verify all the way back to the initiation. And that means to reconfirm all the coins and make sure that there's no errors and there's no interference. Mm-hmm. And that's why when you get to the end, you're talking about trillions of cycles of processing power in order to dig out those last coins at the end, the end of the cycle.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. I really appreciate you going into that description, because it does give me a lot better understanding of how it works. Now, you wanted to go to that second step, which is the actual token. Let's talk about that.
Right. As I prefer to call it is the application layer, because if it's used for coins, they call it the token layer. That's the overlay that goes on top now, that is an independent application that develops the tokens and transactions, and they can be many things. This is why the blockchain is being exploited in so many different directions, because you have application or token developers that are developing many, many types of tokens. For example, one of the other best uses is for contracts, to develop, instead of a token overlaid, the transaction is a contract, an independently mathematically verified contract between two parties. And as you've seen, I don't know if you've noted the current trend of the NFTs, mm-hmm. the non-fungible. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of the NFT? Yeah. That is another version or use of application use of the application or token layer, where it's a non-useful in some ways financial trend. It is the exchange of a piece of replication of a piece of artwork or a photograph, mm-hmm. or something that is important. That, again, like I said, in the old days, right, people traded all kinds of things. I like seashells. He likes carved pieces of whittled pieces of wood, and we can. And that's what the NFTs are for, is when you want to exchange mm-hmm. things that the end players consider of equal value to each other, right. And simply want to exchange and want to have a verifiable, confirmed, independent way of verifying a transaction without the use of a third party, because it's now done mathematically.
Mm-hmm. If I could ask, because that raises a question that I, and that is, you know, we have the Bitcoin cryptocurrency, and then we're I believe headed into a currency system where we have gold and silver and commodities basically setting the value, and it's basically hard set. It's you know, there's a value that's given to an ounce of gold, an ounce of silver, what have you. And in a situation like that, now you have two competing systems, and you know, what's to say that one all of a sudden decides it's going to compete with the other one? Much the same as what we have now in international currencies. You know, one country's currency being manipulated in order to have an advantage over another country's currency. Do you see a problem in that respect when it comes to the difference between a system based on gold, silver commodities, and a cryptocurrency system?
Well, I've actually been advocating. It's a very good question, and I've actually been advocating that that we have a quote unquote bi-technology system, a two basis transaction system that can have a set of metal standards on one side that are either directly or indirectly linked by a producer of a cyber currency to a particular cyber currency as a way to, but that link has to be defined as a one-to-one link, like the old gold and silver standard was. Mm-hmm. You have an ounce of gold and an ounce of silver that represents a dollar or $21 in the system, and that's fixed. Mm-hmm. And at that point, when you make the, you know, and that brings certain limitations. See, this is one of the reasons that we first went to a fractional reserve banking system and then a fiat system, is that was too constraining for the producers of gold, silver, and currency. They wanted to be freed, and this is one of the things that's explained on the video I was talking about with money as debt, that they wanted to overcome, and there's a reason they introduced first fractional reserve and then said, "Oh, the hell with it," threw it all out the window.
And that's the inherent human problem. Oh, gee, we don't like this anymore, and you know, they stepped in. And people not only, you know, yeah, they wanted it free, but they also they found a way for them to take incredible advantage of it. And it had basically been ripping us off for how many hundreds of years?
Exactly. And this is the key thing. Like I explained earlier, this is the key thing about a Bitcoin or a cyber currency algorithm initiation. It doesn't preclude, because you can never preclude the inventiveness of people to come up with some kind of scheme. The difference is versus a monetary in the past, a counterfeiter in the past, is that the investment that has to be made is much greater than it ever was in any of the existing currency system. And the second benefit is that it's much more easily detectable and traceable from the get-go all the way. Remember, unlike the fiat currency system, the cyber currency system can track your transaction out to the release of the first coin. It can be audited and confirmed out to the last coin. Mm-hmm. From end to end. You can audit that entire stream at any point, and if it is interfered with, it is detected almost immediately.
The other step that I can see here is as in the the current central banking system. When you issue something as in fiat currency, what happens is at some point they require some kind of actual item of value to be exchanged for that. All right. And then, because they are now, you know, it's, let's face it, the central bank, they don't, you know, they pay their employees with, you know, Federal Reserve notes. Those Federal Reserve notes come with the same interest, you know, on it. And what they're doing then is, you know, they're exchanging what we perceive as real wealth, as in an ounce of silver, for an instrument of debt. And if they don't have to use that silver in their transactions, then what ends up happening, and it was what we have seen over the past several hundred years, is you know, piles and piles and tons of gold and wealth and real estate, items of real significant value to you, me, and every swinging, you know what, out there. And and then, you know, and as we saw with the Federal Reserve System, they were ready to crash the whole damn thing. And now they're sitting on top of all this real wealth, which has been the, in my opinion, that's been the end game of the central banking system. And you know, now we're all just debt slaves. And again, I see cryptocurrency basically doing the same thing. We're to buy crypto, I have to exchange. Right now they're accepting Federal Reserve notes, which is probably not such a good idea. But if we go to, like, say, this new system that they're planning, where we go back to a U.S. Treasury bill and an actual coinage, now you're still talking, you're going back to more of a tangible instrument of value to exchange for other items of similar value that you need more than you need that piece of silver or that you know, $5 treasury note.
Okay. Well, I'm not quite sure what was the question.
Well, the point that I'm making here is that eventually somebody ends up with all the gold and everybody else has got the debt.
Okay, but what now you're talking about the difference in digital currency versus cyber currency. Okay, and this is again where we get into the confusing, where their idea of digital currency is effectively to take the fiat currency system that with its rules that they have now and simply finish the digitization process to digitize it and give everybody a card that they have to use and that it's totally open and trackable down to the individual. Rather than being an anonymous system. That's the one severe detraction that they're adding to this system with their idea of digital currency, which is not cyber currency. And that's the thing. Digital currency, they want to make use of certain portions of the concept of blockchain for doing, you know, error correction and validations. However, they still want to leave themselves directly involved in the third party process and not leave it up to mathematics and allow it to be manipulatable and to be non-secure and non-private. Okay, unless you go with their basic plan for security by joining their system. Okay, and that's the primary difference between the independent cryptocurrencies and the central banking concept of digital currency. Is you don't get to pick the level of security, the level of privacy, the level of any of it with regard. You go with what the central banks and the international banks and governments decide is the level of security and the level of privacy they're going to allow you. Otherwise, it's all open to their review now. You don't even get the benefit of quote unquote cash in doing anonymous transactions, because you're going to use the card they give you, just like you have a bank card now, that's not independently lockable from their view. You know, on the blockchain, in a blockchain and a cyber currency, the bits of the block that regard who did this transaction, who was it and who did it, that's all not viewable on the blockchain. Those are the blocks of data within the block of each transaction that are encrypted and not viewable by anybody off the block. The transaction where you can look at the transaction or the coins involved, you can look at that on the blockchain. You don't know who the people were. It is completely private and secure, and you don't get to look and see who actually conducted that transaction. You just see the transaction that was done for how much it was, and when it was done, when at what time, and that it was verified and that it's accurate, but no idea as to who did it.
Jeff, I've got a question, and that is, what's to keep the Federal Reserve or to keep the International Monetary Fund and these big international bankers with all the money and the power that they have, what's to keep them from making it illegal to transact in blockchain coinage and blockchain technology?
I guess there's nothing to prevent them from trying. There's everything in the fundamental nature of the technology itself to keep them from being successful at it, and that's the key here, is they can try all day, but as we've seen with all the past efforts of the past 10 years, virtually everything that they have tried to do when it succeeded against a couple of the players or a few of the players, all the others immediately escaped completely they kind of squirreled out in every different direction to keep them from tracking anybody else and from gaining control of anybody else. It's just like the dark net on the internet. You know, that's probably where 90% of the internet actually lies, is in what's known as the dark net, which is like the Wild West down there. The government, even though initially the original architecture was actually developed by ARPA, the Advanced Agency Research Projects, Advanced Research Projects Agency, they're totally incapable of gaining any control of the dark net, like I said, which is 90%. The web, which sits on top of it, is 10%, and the dark web, which sits underneath it, and is everything from FTP, file transfer of private data. There's all kinds of things that go on in what is known as the dark net. But the only reason it's called the dark net is because the government itself is virtually unable to track anything that goes on in the dark net with any level of success, because there is no ability to do that. And exactly the same thing will happen. The harder they try and squeeze against legitimate, you know, it's just like the creation of black markets when they prohibit something. Mm-hmm. You don't stop there's been no stopping of the drug business worldwide. The harder you try and clamp down on the drug business in the white market, okay, by prohibiting it and making it illegal, you just simply expanded the dark market, the black market. And that's essentially the same thing here, is that the harder they try, the more, you know, humans fundamentally are extremely creative. And whether they're on the dark side or the good side, they're creative. And mm-hmm. if you want to restrict the legitimate side and the white side, you're going to do is force legitimate players who aren't actually doing anything wrong, but are now being classified as being illegal. You're simply going to force it, just like what Prohibition did. Mm-hmm. Okay. They simply exploded the black market for liquor. And that's exactly what they're going to do here. Only the technology allows them to be a lot more creative in the way that that's done.
I see. Okay. Well, that makes sense. Well, let me ask you this. How do you identify good and bad cryptos if we're talking now in value? I know obviously Bitcoin was kind of set the standard for the whole industry, but there's a lot of different cryptos out there. How do you determine which ones are worthy and good quality and which ones are not?
And at this stage, see, the other thing to understand about this is, even though it's a transaction and eventual monetary instrument, mm-hmm. we're not in that phase yet. We are in the asset only phase of the initiation of all of these cryptocurrencies that have been developed, all the tokens that are out there now, everything there. You know, there's somewhere in the neighborhood, and I'm sure if I looked it up, there's actually more, much more than that now. But the last time I did any thorough research, there's about 2,000 altcoins on the market right now. Are 90% of them worth anything? No. Okay. Because like I said, we're not in the monetization phase, we're in the asset phase. Mm-hmm. And asset speculation, just like in the initial tech boom, we're in the altcoin business and cyber currency business, we're in the late 80s. We're about to go through, we haven't been through the late 80s yet in tech. There was a lot of people, and people like me in the initial, I started out in the cyber world in the mid 1970s through the Naval Security Group and the National Security Agency, and then migrated into the defense systems business, and then into the commercial systems and technology business in private industry, and ended my career at Bell Laboratories. But that's mm-hmm. And that's the same. I mean, I look at this as proceeding exactly like the technology market proceeded. We're in the late 80s phase right now of the initial tech boom, when all these things that we'd been working on since the 60s and 70s finally started to produce some viable end products that we could really go out to the market for, everything from home computers to communications technologies. After the mid 80s, when the internet spec was released to the commercial market in 84, that's when things started to gel. And by the mm-hmm. late 80s, that was the initial tech boom. Well, that's where we're at in the cyber currency market right now, is we're at the end of the 80s and just about getting ready to explode. Everything that you've seen gone on so far it's just a fraction of what's about to happen in the next 10 years, particularly as the financial and fiat currency system that exists right now finishes going exponential and starts to completely come apart because of its inherent flaws and fundamental problems.
Well, now I know that there are different companies around who are advising people on which cryptocurrencies are valid and viable and which ones are not. What's the criteria for a valid or a good crypto versus a one that doesn't have much upside future to it?
Well, as in all speculative asset markets, that's the thing that has to be researched to understand what technology they're proposing using and how they're going to implement it, what their business model is for how they plan to market and sell it, and what their sustainability factors are with regard to the long-term stability and growth of the whether it's a currency or a token or an application overlay like a non-fungible type of transaction application, depending on what your research says and what their white paper, every one of them produces a white paper. Every one of the token companies currently, and the NFTs, I believe as well, they produce a white paper just like the original Bitcoin white paper that was produced by Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever that is. They produce a white paper that fully explains what their architecture, technology, plan is, and then separate from that, they have a company and growth plan to explain how they're going to implement their financing scheme through their coin or through investment, and how they're going to grow and develop and establish and stabilize the company and the currency, if it happens to be a currency, as just like a bank getting into quote unquote getting into business, another bank. But it's independent. It's completely independent of the existing banking system. Although you may have banks who eventually realize they either have to actually compete in that market instead of just adopt and follow a government currency standard and say, oh, we're now going to no longer be this bank, and we're going to become a cyber currency or token or application based entity doing somewhat similar things, but maybe not anything real to do with direct financial transactions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So basically it's like evaluating any kind of business plan and looking at who the principals are that put this business plan together, how they plan to implement the business plan, how they plan to fund the business plan, and how they plan to run the organization after that business plan is fully implemented. That's basically like you would evaluate virtually any business in the world if you were a banker or any other entity, and you were looking at this as a potential investment. You have to look at it that same way. Is that what you're telling
me? Right. You have to be in this stage. Right now, you have to be a more sophisticated investor, unless you're going to be just a user. If you're not going to be, if you're going to be any more than a user, well, just like you and I do with a bank now, we rely on the long known traditional method of that's a solid bank. Okay, they have good business practices. We understand. So there's not much chance of them going bankrupt. And if we do, okay, we got the FDIC to quote unquote back it up, which is kind of another one of those fallacies.
Right.
But you know, we have these mechanisms that we use, and it's kind of like going to be the same mechanisms that you use to verify and approve your cyber bank or your cyber transaction company. You have to use the same and it's actually better, again, because you're not going to sit back and just say, oh, well, they're FDIC backed. I don't care because I'll be protected. Okay. Mm-hmm. No, you better understand and know, especially if you're going with a smaller startup bank, you better know who they are, what they're doing, how they do it, and how good their business model and plan is for ensuring their long-term stability and to protect your investment and deposit, whatever that happens to be.
Mm-hmm. Hey, okay, Jeff, I've been copying and pasting some questions out of our live chat. They're in the Zoom chat there. If you want to just scroll through those and address some of the questions from our live chat there.
Okay. Sure. Let's see. We got one from our chat front there. Okay. Here's the first question I hit here is, what if there's a run on the Bitcoin bank? Okay, well, a very good question. Okay, and I only see, that's interesting. It says I have five here, but I only see one on the chat. I don't know.
Let me see if I can. That's the most recent one. That's good. That's good to go. There's a couple other comments there.
Okay.
Not necessarily questions.
Okay. What if there's a run on the bank? There are some similarities. There are some similarities to any. It's just like any company, any private company that got itself into trouble and started doing something that was found out to be either corrupt or bad or was jeopardizing the current investors in that currency, or like say. In the case of national currency, say it's Venezuela, okay, and the Bolivar, and what's happening to Venezuela, and I got all my money in Bolivars, and what if we have a run on a national currency? There's many ways to address those issues, one of which would be, okay, do you either have independent insurance or is there other mechanisms to assure something like a bank run on a cyber currency? Or in the event of fraud, what are the protections that are available to any holder of a Bitcoin? And again, one of those basic is inherent in the architecture, is in the mathematical integrity of the transaction as well, and of the coin issuer. Now, some of this is going to be a little bit difficult to address until we get to the monetization stage. Because we're just only in the asset phase, and these are problems that need to be worked out, as to what mechanisms will we have available to us to handle a run. So I can speculate about, you know, they will do similar things that have been done in the past, and they're going to do some new things based on the advantages of both the technology and the application tokens them well as well in order to address some of these problems. So, but like I said, it can be handled anywhere from insurance against the account, either private insurance or it could become inherent in the actual token application as well. Or it could be, something like independent takeovers, okay, where independent, other independent, there could, you know, one of the things that's starting to emerge is among the altcoin makers themselves are independent,
like takeovers,
audit groups, and that they can get together and say, oh, we're gonna, you know, we're gonna take over that coin, and we'll bail it out as other altcoin producers and providers, and we'll bring it into our fold and ensure its viability. So, it's that's one of the ones that's it's since we're not in the monetization stage yet. That's one of the things that some thought is I'm sure right now among many of the coin producers is being worked out, because they know the closer this comes and the more it becomes obvious I mean, first, right now, I think the hardest thing for people to assume is that or think about is that is Bitcoin and alt currencies and all this, could it just go away? And disappear, and you know, the whole thing. I would say with each passing day now, that becomes highly more and more unlikely to happen. It's becoming, I mean, the asset valuation is currently something over $1.3 trillion. And I think that's you're going to see in the next 10 years, that's going to go up probably 10 times what it currently is, because as we get into this transition and how all of the pieces and parts get worked out between the existing financial and banking system and this one. And but I think my opinion is that the existing financial infrastructure and fiat currency monetary system globally is on its last legs. We're going into the exponential phase on the debt. I mean, when I looked at the Federal Reserve's latest monetary base figures, and they hit 10 trillion. Okay, and recognize that that's about 10 times what it was 12 years ago.
Right.
The monetary base. That allows the creation. That $10 trillion monetary base is signaling that allows the creation into the future of, depending on what fractional reserve value establish, between $100 and $300 trillion in eventual injection of currency into the economic system. Mm-hmm. There is no way that we're going to survive that, and it's going to create huge distortions if that is allowed to occur. But my view of the Federal Reserve currently is that they're doing everything possible that they can to figure out a way, and it's going to mostly take place through default and loss reduction in reducing that monetary base, so that the eventual currency creation doesn't take us from massive to hyperinflationary. Mm-hmm. I think at this point we're almost guaranteed massive inflation. But I think they'll do whatever they do to do asset write-downs galore in order to keep us from hyperinflation.
Wow.
Jeff, I'm Thumper, excuse me for a second here, but I want to get into something that, and Thumper, you brought this up earlier when we were talking, what happens if the grid goes down? The other side of that is that all these so-called green people plan on drastically reducing the amount of electricity that we are going to be allocated. And obviously the mining process and the crypto process is highly dependent on electricity and on the ability to be able to generate a tremendous amount of computer activity. How do we deal with that?
Well, I guess I'll address the first question first on what's going to happen. What's going to happen with regard to electrical consumption. And, you know, I always ask the question. I say, anytime you have one of these questions that come up, ask yourself how that would apply to the existing system. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And without even considering cybercurrency, what would that do? What would an EMP or a CME, a magnetic pulse or a mass ejection, mm-hmm. what would that do to the existing system? Well, the first thing it would do is it would mean a massive CME that takes out any significant percentage of the global energy grid, the electrical grid. And this is something I'm pretty familiar with because I first started mm-hmm. studying in my work back in the 70s. We did some of the first EMP and CME studies on our networks at that point in various projects long before that the general population even became aware of what a EMP or a CME what it is. Okay, and the first thing you have to realize is that in a massive CME or EMP event, you basically, I would just simply ask is how does any monetary system work in the event of that, given that 97% of the existing currency is only electronic in the existing system and 3% paper currency. And the fact that you have literally in a gold and silver system, other than and what is more likely to happen, since most people don't own gold and silver, is what you would see first is you would see barter systems that would spring up in order to take to address that problem. You would even be quite a while, months if not years, getting back to even a precious metal exchange standard. You would just simply be going into a barter exchange system mm-hmm. from the base. And so, and you're talking about 5 billion people currently are only sustained on this planet and only capable of being alive because of the information technology system that exists in doing all of the logistics and providing all of the logistics transfer and transactions that are currently provided. So, and how do we deal with that?
Yeah.
5 billion people. So when it comes to, you know, when people just come down to and say, well, you know, it's Bitcoin doesn't work in a EMP and CME event. Well, neither does anything else that we absolutely mm-hmm. rely on to exist. So I say that the problem people have to think about is what do we do at all in that right. situation, right. and how would you address it?
If I could throw something in here. By the way, I'm a 14-year veteran of the United States Navy as well. I understand you're
very good.
And I'm very familiar with the cryptologic community. I don't know if you saw the background I put up there for just a moment.
I missed that. I'm sorry.
I was an EP3E.
Oh, okay.
Okay, if you're familiar with those.
Yeah. You didn't get airsick, did you?
No. You know that one airplane that landed on the Chinese island after the little air incident.
Yes.
I put lots of hours on that aircraft a few years prior to that incident.
That must have been really fun. There was several incidents that went on over in Asia when I was over there, and with P3s, all the surveillance.
Yeah.
I'm sure you saw a lot of different things like that.
The Korean airliner was one of my on top of the day after, only because they wouldn't let us take off the day it happened.
Interesting. Yeah, that was. I actually was involved 3 years prior. 3 years prior to that, with developing the initial system that was the actual created the actual problem when they passed over the peninsula and got themselves shot down. That we had been trying to packetize and put on a Blackbird, but weren't successful. Up to three years previously, it was three cabinets of equipment.
Yeah.
But that's a whole nother discussion.
Yeah, well, that's a whole nother world, isn't it?
Yeah.
However, one of the things that I've been looking at, and the Navy has been putting out there, is new patents that is involving some pretty advanced technologies. One of them is they've actually released a patent on basically, simple terms, anti-gravity.
Yeah, I saw those.
And then the other one on the small packaged cold fusion, hydrogen fusion patent out there. So, and you're talking about a package that would fit in the nose cone of the way the article explained it was in the nose cone of an F-15. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at a time when we're going to have, this whole electrical grid could very well be, non-existent in the future. And each home has its own ability to generate their own electricity, at which point about the only thing you need is maybe a fiber optic line between your house and the servers and things like that. You don't have, in an EMP situation, the idea of burning out these massive transformers, burning out transmission lines, that all goes away. So we're looking at a time when, new technologies I truly believe I'm one of those woo-woo guys. I think that we're on the cusp of this stuff. So that's going to change things dramatically as well, especially when it comes down to transactions, financial transactions and things like that. We're not going to be so tied into this this grid, as we call it. We're going to be a lot more independent at that point.
You're exactly right. Yes, you're exactly right. I mean, there is a whole different. We're at the beginning of a set of transitions that a lot of people don't recognize. Whether you look into quantum, the things that are going on in quantum principles and quantum mechanics right now, and the very real implementations that are starting to roll out in quantum computing, quantum internet. All kinds of things that are going on, which is going to have an impact on this market as well. But we have so many far in advance. We are at the very beginning of a very interesting 30 years right now, where we're going to see everything from the large scale development of space-based industries to extremely advanced computing and these are all going to raise similar issues. And I had a couple of preliminary discussions with Dan. I think it would be good if we came back and discussed some of these things additionally in other programs about what these technologies are going to mean in other respects while this financial transition is taking hold and making these changes. But it's, as I tell my son all the time, is because he constantly tells me, he goes, to him, it's looking like, well, the opening of this era is going to be a disaster coming. And I said, I'd sure like to be 30 years younger with the things.
I'm with you. I'm with you, Jeff. Absolutely.
With things that are going on.
I think that we do live in miraculous and amazing times. And if we make it through this without pulling our hair out or, Biden falling down the stairs and we end up with,
call me Harris,
Harris, I think that, you know, once we make it through this this phase, it's actually going to be an amazing world.
Yes, absolutely. This is the scary part right now, is whether people generally, and I think Jordan Peterson is going a long way towards addressing this by explaining very well with extreme logic and rationality and why the neo-Marxist and this whole movement that we see is not only so counterintuitive, but is so counterproductive mm-hmm. to what we have coming, which is actually represents so much more freedom and the exercise of liberty. And as I try to tell, and it's very difficult in many cases, dealing with folks in my age peer group, because they don't know anything about any of these technologies, mm-hmm. and it's very hard to bring them up to speed and get them to understand why all they see is bad. And I'm going, it's just like the problem we've wrestled with on firearms. They're good and they're bad, but the good outweighs the bad because most of us are good and not bad.
Well, it's the operator. It's not the firearm.
Exactly.
The operator.
Exactly.
And the same thing holds true in banking and business and everything else. You know, I spent the last almost 30 years running I've owned my own insurance agency here in Spokane. And, you want to see the deep state. You want to see, the manipulation of people. You want to see, how these corporations have taken advantage of us. You know, try running an insurance agency for 30 years.
I can see.
Oh, good God. You know, and people, you know, Dan and I have had this conversation numerous times. We've had social scoring in this country for about 10 years now, and they started it out. They called it your insurance score. Which was made up of your FICA score and then all the other underwriting information that your insurance companies gather about you, and then buy it from all these other companies that are sweeping through the newly digitized old financial records from your county and state records and things like that, digitizing it and selling it out to these insurance companies, and the insurance companies are using that in order to use their black box to underwrite your butt to figure out how much money they can get out of you. Mm-hmm. My own insurance company here a few years ago came back and they doubled my homeowner's insurance because they said they found my name out on the dark web. And I'm like, excuse me. So what does that mean? I've watched this mess develop. I'm very concerned. And one of the things that I hear from a lot of people about the cryptos is that, who's really is pushing this? Because we get the impression that, that central banks, they're evil. Soros, he's evil. Bill Gates, he's evil. We see where there's a lot of people out here whom have created a lot of problems for us, who seem to be backing the crypto, and if they're backing it, I don't know. It makes me want to run away the other way.
Well, part of it, and again, these this is a very good question because. It brings up what is it that they're backing is what has to be looked at. And is it the digital, again, it's the confusion between the digital currency system versus the cyber currency system. And in fact, when you have pieces that they may even be using, like the banks, all the big central banks are looking at using some form of the blockchain. Mm-hmm. As well, and as a technology, again, it's the taking of a technology, whether it's a gun or a blockchain, and it's whether you devise an evil application for it, and like a gun, shoot somebody to rob them, or you devise a good application. And people have to constantly remain awareness. What I call 360 degree awareness on these items is to what exact discussion are they listening to? That is one of the most difficult things in this whole cyber currency. When you hear terms is and you have to understand what those terms are, which ones they're using and what they're applying them to. And that's why I stress to people a lot when they hear these discussions of both who is making the statement and what it is that they're actually saying, is understanding what they're applying it to and what they're talking about, because that a lot of times people get very confused between all of these terms and issues, mainly because they're so new and it's easy to do. And so the only things I hear when I've heard Gates and the others, when I listen to them and the central bankers, they're talking about digital currency. They're not talking about actual cyber currencies as we're talking about here and how it actually works. They're talking about just another version in electronic form of the same old damn system they've had for 100 years now, that they've run to the end, and they're going to try and reboot it one more time. But that is definitely not what the cyber currencies are, and what the altcoins and the various token level applications that are being independently discussed here by the altcoin or cyber currency industry in and of itself. There's two very similar sounding but independent and separate discussions going on that sound a lot alike and are hard to and have to be understood, to be picked out and ferreted through to really understand.
Jeff, I want to ask a question, because we're going to run out of time. We knew we were going to, but something that comes up is, how can our listeners, how can average people become much more well-educated on the whole idea of blockchain technology and the new cryptocurrencies? Because it sounds to me like this is the trend that we need to be learning more about for future use.
Well, you're exactly right. And interestingly enough, this kind of runs us back to the beginning of the program that we kind of immediately got off of. What I keep enunciating and trying to emphasize is that people first become aware of what money is. Mm-hmm. This is one of the, you know, everybody seems to think that they actually understand what money is. But every time I get into a discussion, I always find out that very, very few people actually understand what the three basic principles of money are and how they work and how they're applied. That's why I always recommend you need to go back and review the understanding of money, because once you understand the concept of money itself, it becomes much easier to understand what cyber currency is versus digital currency versus fiat currency in the existing mm-hmm. regime, and what the trade-offs are between the various ones and where we need to go. And it's always been surprising and shocking to me. I guess it was simply because I simply had both parents and early mentors, if you will, who pounded certain things into my head to understand that I don't think a lot of people ever go through in understanding mm-hmm. I had an old fishing buddy, strangely enough, of my dad's, who really hard pounded into my head about what money is, what is money and how does it work. And on camping trips and I would say of my early training and understanding what money, I didn't get, of course, like today. You don't get any of it out of school. And I think this is a huge, huge disadvantage for our society, is that this understanding of what is money and what is the banking system and how does it work. And like I said, I got that nowhere in the education system. And I found out later, the more and more advanced education I got in a number of areas, I always fell back on those fundamentals very quickly. But learning what money is at the very essence, the fundamentals, is the best way to first then begin to learn about cyber currency, just as much as learning about why it has these advantages versus, because that's what I seem to deal with so often with people, is simply the basic misunderstanding of what money is to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes sense. I want you to talk a little bit, because people, I don't think people realize that you are kind of a super patriot on top of being somebody incredibly sharp about the whole idea of information technology and, you know, the cryptocurrency thing. Talk a little bit about your book, The Citizen's Last Stand, Are You Ready? Talk a little bit about that book, because that's when I was first introduced to you. I bought your book at one of the events that you were attending. I read the book and I said, man, I've got to talk to this guy. I've got to get more information. I did that even before I was doing radio, just because your book was so dynamite.
Well, thank you. And this is, and basically all of all the other aspects, and one of the attempts that I made in The Citizen's Last Stand is to document the journey, and then in the first part, and then outline through the bulk of the book what the features of the transition that we're now directly into are going to look like, back when I wrote it in 2012. And you know, the problem was, as I realized over time, even though I sold several thousand copies, which is satisfactory, but it really didn't get a big boom, because a lot of people just came back to me and said, man, this is I don't get this, and this is difficult. And I said, yeah, but you will in a very short period of time. And I said you're going to get it. And I get a lot of contacts these days from people that read it 8 years ago, and then all of a sudden realized that, oh, gee, this stuff that's happening is exactly what I was talking about 8 years ago. And so it's kind of undergoing a reinvigoration of people looking into why did these things that I was talking about then are now suddenly applying? And mm-hmm. It was very easy to see when the black swan of the COVID event started.
Right, right.
That this was the first black swan now that was going to finally tear all the band-aids off. And it was just going to go from one to the other, and that we were entering what I called in the book, the main sequence. We're now entering the main sequence of the transition, that if it goes badly, it could take 15 to 20 years. If it goes well, we could start to really get out of this in 8 to 10 years. But it's going to be based on the number of people that truly start to sit down and educate themselves and understand what it is that we're entering, and how are we going to get out of it? And like I said, another very good source I see on the social cultural side is what Jordan Peterson is trying to get across with his books. He's very good at laying out all of the idiotic tropes of the left, and how they're trying to destroy and confuse and manipulate society, which understandably is extremely fearful of what's happening right now. and that there, and that we have to do this through, there's only one way to do this, is the leftists will do it through violence, violence and chaos. Our only way to do this is through logic, education, and understanding. And as Jordan Peterson said, and love. And until we have more people that learn how to block all of this interfering fog that they're trying to throw into up in front of everybody right now in order to get the chaos to come out in their favor, we have to have enough people anchored and rooted in the fundamental understanding of each of the important areas, like what is money, mm-hmm. right? What are rights? What is money? What is liberty? All these things that have to have some anchored roots that we can work off of to move forward, to make sure that the leftists and these Marxist communist idiots don't manage to persuade a large enough percentage of the population to allow them to take over, and then they'll wind up murdering millions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, ultimately, I think, Jeff, we all recognize the fact that part of the whole program that they've got in mind is a massive eugenics program that would eliminate, even in their own words, eliminate most of the world's population, reduce the world's population to fewer than a billion people. This is all part of this goofy Agenda 21, 2030, Green New Deal, Marxist idea, because they hate, as the saying that I use frequently is that they claim to love humanity, they just hate humans.
Right. And that's and I ask all my socialist friends all the time, or the ones that I the democratic socialists who are leaning that direction. I sit there and go, when you talk about this better world, have you fully understood whether you're in the ones that are going to be eliminated or the ones that are going to stick around?
Yeah.
And because they never think about that, because
they eat their own.
Yeah, and I tell them, I said, well, you better go and look at what happened to the Soviet Union or China, or pick one, because yeah, they eat their own, and you're probably going to be in the first one of the first groups that disappear, because you're just a useful tool, so you better get ready for that.
We have a question out here. What's the name of Jordan Peterson's book that you referred to?
The 12 rules of life.
The 12 rules of life. Okay. You get that place in May 2033 out there in chat.
Yeah. The something close to that. The 12 rules, something very close to that. And, I think that, like I said, I think he's been one of the, I think there, when people like that emerge, they emerge because they're touching on exactly the right note at the right moment.
Dan's writing down the name. He's going to be a guest here soon, I have.
Yeah, he will be. Yeah, that's kind of what he has in mind.
He's a clinical psychologist, and he just annihilates these Marxist-Leninist idiots that proliferate. That I think, and with very. And he makes them see up front at the moment, right in front of their face, just how idiotic what they're saying is to themselves, where they literally stop talking because they can't
respond. Yeah.
You mean they can't anymore. Even come up with an ist name to call them, you know, misogynist, racist.
They've already usually done that, right? They've done that. And he that's the first thing he addresses right down the line. And like I said, and then they have nothing more to talk about because he addresses every one of the things that they've tried to paint him with and shown how there's, you can't even apply it. Mm-hmm. And it just, it really messes up. Like I said, he is so good at annihilating, and you can learn a lot. I've learned an awful lot just by watching his methods, how to do that. with these social, everyone's from the social Democrats all the way to the Marxist Leninists, how to just shut them down.
And Jordan Peterson is the author of those books. For those of you folks out there, that's what Jeff is replying to there. Sounds like a lot of our people in chat might enjoy grabbing that book as well as Citizens' Last Stand.
Yeah, and we'll get them on the program, Lumper. That's exactly why I was writing that down.
Hey, you know, I'm getting to know you pretty well.
Yeah, you sure are. Well, I hate to say it, Jeff, but we've run out of time, and it looks like Pam's ready. I'm not sure if Patrick is on with us yet, but we do need to get you back, because I would love to talk with you about the future that you see this next 30 years that we were talking about, and how the technology, because I know that you really understand this much better than 99.9% of the people out there. It would be a great, really eye-opening expose of what we've got in the future and how we can protect that.
Well, thank you, Dan, and I appreciate that very much. I think this is highly important and critical to where we're going, is that people start to have much more optimism about the future than they appear to right now, because there is a whole lot of optimism out there in what's coming, and it's not as scary as people think. It is going to be interesting, and it's not going to be easy, but what I see in the young people is giving me a lot of encouragement, because there are a lot of young people who are tuning in and know how this works.
Well, yeah. In fact, I've seen the same thing. We did another Red Pill Expo out in Jekyll Island, Georgia. And one of the highlights of that trip was the fact that about 30 or 35% of the audience at that trip was somewhere around 30 years old and younger. And Ed Griffin and his wife, Pat, and my wife, Ingrid, and myself were at the Jekyll Island Club, where the Federal Reserve Act was put together, the whole genius behind that thing. And it was after the Bard closed down, and we suddenly found ourselves surrounded by 20 and 30 age group people who were there that wanted to pick our brain and learn more about sound money and some of the other things.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife. I'd thank my lucky stars to be living here today,
where the flag still stands for freedom, and they can't take that away.
And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me.
And I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today, 'cause her reign.